The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and I'm joined this week by the investigative journalist Annie Jacobson, whose new book is Nuclear War, A Scenario, which is described as a non-fiction thriller, and it is terrifying and compulsive in equal measure. Annie, can you start by telling me what you were trying to do with this book exactly? What was the conception behind it?
So as an investigative journalist, I have previously written 6 books on war, weapons, national security, and secrets. All of the programs inside of those books, all of the sources I have used to report those books, have shared with me that everything they have done has been dedicated, in essence, to prevent nuclear World War III. And so I began thinking right around the time of the pandemic, when we had a former president in office who used a lot of nuclear rhetoric for the first time in decades. I began asking myself as a reporter, my God, what would happen if deterrence or prevention failed? And I began asking that exact question of sources who I have longstanding relationships with here in the United States, many of whom are at the uppermost echelons of national security. And what I learned shocked me. And there began writing and reporting Nuclear War, A Scenario.
Well, you obviously have these very high up sources, but you know, one question that immediately strikes me is, this is the most secret, most classified, pretty much, of anything. If we assume that America's military industrial secret state is any good at all at keeping secrets, is it likely that you're able to have got that close? I mean, you'd think, isn't the information in this going to necessarily be a little bit out of date or a little bit declassified?
What an important question you just asked. And that was exactly my thought. You know, after I thought, no one is going to talk to me about the most classified concept of programs, system of programs in the security apparatus, and that is nuclear command and control. That's what I thought. And so, yes, my book does take you right up to the razor's edge of what can be known in terms of public perception. But equally shocking was the fact that all of my sources simply pointed me to declassified documentation, to very, shall we say, nerdy treatises or monographs that had already existed by people who are dedicated to nuclear non-proliferation. These things are there. And yet, the takeaway, certainly of my reporting, was like, wow, this is here for us to know. And yet, most people don't know, including myself in many regards. The things I learned shocked even me as I write. And so that begs this really important question that, like, it particularly now that we see this god-awful rhetoric escalating by the day, nuclear-armed nations that are in direct conflict with one another threatening the use of weapons of mass destruction. This is madness. And so I believe the time is over to have that ostrich head in the sand approach and rather become aware of what could actually happen. Because that's the fundamental reason why so many of these individual sources, highly placed, went on the record with me, many of them for the first time.
And they were wanting to get this information out there. I mean, some of the stuff you've said that's in these nerdy documents spread out here and there was from the people who were originally designing these programs or working on these programs, who would sort of semi-deliberately, by the seams, let this stuff slip. Now, is that simply kind of terrible failure of national security? Or is that them thinking this information needs to be out there?
I would by no means classify it as letting it slip, meaning the individuals who work in national security, in my experience, those with, you know, highly classified information at their fingertips, their whole careers, do not release classified information. They are sort of trained that way. And so they can point a reporter like myself to an area of investigation that has been declassified, but that has sort of just gone under the radar and not been that interesting to people. This has certainly been my experience throughout all my reporting of all of my books. And I think in particular, to your point about why now, why did these sort of cold warriors who are now in their 80s, some of them in their 90s, speak so candidly on the record? And it was very simple. And it was a thread that repeated itself throughout many of my interviews. This kind of idea, and I'm paraphrasing here, we thought we had this covered. Meaning, we thought we survived the Cold War without a nuclear conflict with Russia. And here we are in 2024 in a place where that threat, even by the United States president's own words, is as high as it's been since the Cuban Missile Crisis of the early 1960s.
Yeah. You say that a lot you found surprised and shocked you. I mean, for, I think, most of our listeners, the general idea that a nuclear war would be a global catastrophe of unprecedented proportions isn't going to come as a surprise. What is it that you found that really did stand out as something that most people wouldn't have guessed or wouldn't have expected?
I was shocked at how systematic the whole situation is. In other words, once A happens, B happens, and then C happens, and then the possibility tree branches out to a bunch of other nightmare scenarios. Let me give you an example. It all begins with me finding out and then reporting to readers some very basic nuclear war fighting policies that exist on the record and have been part of America's idea about nuclear war since the earliest days. And the first sort of most terrifying thing that readers have to confront with as fact is a policy called launch on warning. And that is precisely as it sounds. Now, I went to former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry with the question like, Secretary Perry, some people say this is not really our policy. Can you please clarify? And he said to me in no uncertain terms, when we are warned of a nuclear launch, we launch. That is policy. And so you can see that kind of specificity I went for in talking to sources, because a lot of this information is obfuscated, at least here. Launch on warning means the United States does not wait to absorb a nuclear blow and then regroup and say, hey, what should we do about this? Rather, once the national security apparatus is notified of launch, then we launch in response. And you might say to yourself, if you're thinking of 9/11 or of Pearl Harbor, right? Never mind the technological advances, but you might say, well, how would we know it's coming? And then you learn that's precisely what trillions of dollars have been spent to set that situation up. So, for example, one specific of this is that the United States has a satellite system in space, several of which are parked over the sort of most threatening nations like North Korea. The system is called Cerberus. It's made by Lockheed. That stands for Space-Based Infrared System of Satellites. And those satellites can detect the hot rocket exhaust on a nuclear launch in less than a second after launch. So that kind of detail that you learn, or I learned as I began to report this book, would then set off a series of questions on my part and answers from the national security experts that I interviewed for the book.
One of the things that really is startling about the book is how fast everything moves. I mean, you describe, which I'm still not quite sure I can credit, that something like 15 seconds after, you know, a missile first ignites in North Korea, you've got people running across the tarmac to aeroplanes in Canada, which kind of enough.
In Colorado, yes, but
Colorado, sorry, not Colorado.
That's okay. But you learn how quick, yeah. Like, then you realize, so, oh my goodness, there are literally hundreds of thousands of people in the nuclear command and control apparatus who rehearse the possibility of any of this happening and are at the ready to act 24 hours a day, every minute of every year. And so, yes, within seconds, that information from the satellite gets processed and sent down to Earth, specifically to three command bunkers in the United States. One is very famous, the Cheyenne Mountain Complex. You've seen it in the movies. The other is also famous. It's beneath the Pentagon, and it's called the National Military Command Center. And the third is a bunker beneath STRATCOM, which stands for Strategic Command, which is essentially the organization that controls the nukes. And that's located in the center of the country in Nebraska. And as you said, within seconds, those three command structures and all the organizations involved, from NORAD to the Space Force, they are all working now to interpret that data and get ready to brief the president once they have what's called a secondary confirmation of that information.
Now, the president in this, obviously he's in some sense the most important figure, but you have him being kind of picked up by his armpits and hustled across rooms, you know, again, in seconds. He doesn't seem as in control of the situation as we might have imagined. Is that something you're confident about?
I am. And every action that happens in the book stems from an interview I did with an individual who has firsthand knowledge of one or more situations that represent that happening. And so anyone who wants to nerd out can turn to the last 100 pages of the book, which are the notes, which are the sources, the documents, and the interviews that I did to make that come alive. For example, with the president, I interviewed members of the Secret Service, not just the Secret Service, but the very specific counter-assault team, which is the president's paramilitary team. And then even within that organization, there is a unit called the Element, which is responsible for the president in a time of crisis like this, which would be responsible for whisking the president out of the bunker beneath the White House off to a separate bunker, in this case, Raven Rock, which is also known as the alternative National Military Command Center, like the one beneath the Pentagon. And so I found out from former secretaries of defense, for example, just how, shall we say, ill-informed the United States presidents since President Kennedy apparently have been with regard to what their responsibilities would be in the moments after learning of a nuclear attack at America.
Why is that? I mean, I remember hearing from somebody about, you know, the security briefing that incoming British prime ministers get, and Tony Blair walking out of his looking 10 years older. They obviously get a pretty thorough debriefing here. Do they just not trouble the president with his duties at the end of the world?
You know, again, I was just as surprised in learning this information as you seem to have been reading it. The best answer I can offer, the wisest perspective, came from former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta in our interview. Now, keep in mind, Panetta also served as the CIA director. And before that, he was the White House chief of staff for President Clinton. And so he wore these different hats that gave him a real window into the president, into the lane, a very specific lane of presidential assistance, shall we say. And what Panetta told me was that, for example, when he was White House chief of staff, President Clinton was preoccupied with domestic affairs and seemed very, you know, the idea of nuclear command and control was way down the list of priorities. And so I asked him, well, what about when you were CIA director? Like, how much time did you dedicate to nuclear, thinking about nuclear war? And he shared with me that that was very limited. Again, we were fighting the war on terror. He was going after bin Laden. There were very serious national security issues in the United States that had very little to do with nuclear war. He said that only when he became Secretary of Defense and he began to tour the facilities, the underground bunkers, the missile silos, the submarine bases, did he realize the full weight of his responsibilities as Secretary of Defense. Because as I report in the book, even though the president doesn't need the permission of the Secretary of Defense to launch nuclear weapons, it's a sole authority decision, the president almost certainly leaned on his Secretary of Defense for advice.
One thing parenthetically, there's quite a shocking bit early on where you say in the 50s there was a plan for first launch, for first strike, which would essentially, I think they worked out, you know, wipe out one third of everybody in China. Does that plan still exist as you understand it?
And that is a great national security secret. Whether or not any nuclear-armed nation is willing to make a preemptive nuclear strike. You see that in the rhetoric all the time, you know, individuals asking the president to commit to the fact that there is what's called no first nuclear use. And in my understanding, a lot of presidents come into office saying, I am going to change this around and have that be policy. And then you almost always, or at least historically, see that idea fall by the wayside. And that is an idea, I believe, that continues to, you know, sort of amplify and magnify nuclear saber rattling. Because if you look historically, you see how that idea is what sort of terrified the Soviet Union more than anything. This idea that the United States was going to make a preemptive nuclear strike to try to essentially regime change. And when you look at history, you realize that that fear was not entirely unwarranted, meaning when America was at the height of its sort of hawkish behavior about nuclear weapons in the 1950s and early 1960s, you see precisely that. You see now declassified documents talking about plans if we had to make a preemptive strike. And that's how you get to understand. And I try to do this very briefly in the book so that readers don't get bogged down with history, but get a taste of understanding how we wound up here with 12,500 nuclear weapons on the planet and 9 nuclear armed nations.
Well, can we talk a bit about your scenario that you think of? Now, you start with, it's a sort of rogue nation scenario. It's a North Korea. You've got your mad king, your mad despot, who inexplicably launches a single ICBM and then follows up with a surprise attack from a submarine. What makes you see that as a plausible or the plausible scenario? Because I think somebody in your sort of fictionalized recounting of it says, why would anyone just start by launching one missile?
That's right. And that is the fundamental of deterrence, right? That if we have a big enough arsenal pointed at everybody, no one will dare attack us because apocalypse would follow. And that's what all sides consider. That's the fundamental of deterrence. And yet that's the weakness of deterrence. And I went to all my different sources asking their perception of scenarios. And I landed on the rogue nuclear launch out of North Korea after Richard Garwin, now 93, the original architect of the thermonuclear weapon. People think Teller, but in fact, Richard Garwin drew the architectural plans for the original thermonuclear bomb when Teller could not get past the conception. And so Garwin, you could argue, knows more about nuclear weapons than anyone on the planet because he's been at the fore since the 50s. And Garwin shared with me that the big fear has always been the Mad King theory. And he cited the Napoleon sort of phrase, après moi le déluge, this idea that, well, after I die, who the hell cares? And so specifically, I chose a rogue launch. And the present day individual who is acting a bit like the Mad King to my eye is the leader of North Korea. And that sets the stage for a theoretical scenario that is very plausible and has nothing to do with policy and posturing, and perhaps more to do with rogue behavior.
As you say, there's a sort of series of iron links in terms of policy that come in response to that. I mean, the scary figure you have is 6 minutes. Can you explain what the significance of 6 minutes is?
6 minutes to doomsday. I mean, the president gets informed around 5 minutes. And again, 5 minutes after launch, the president is learning about what is going on because he has to make a decision about counterattack, according to U.S. policy, in approximately 6 minutes. Some say it's 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I sourced this to President Reagan himself, where in his memoirs, he talks about this 6 minute window of decision. And he even says something to the effect of, you know, 6 minutes to unleash the apocalypse. This is irrational. And so I use that number because it's a commonly spoken of number. Of course, it's going to change as it does in the scenario if, for example, the Secret Service team decides that they need to move the president while he's within this 6 minute window making decision period. So you can begin to see how the decision tree has effects that are beyond other people's control.
Why is it 6 minutes? I mean, what are the parameters that, is that how long it takes the missile to hit your missiles?
Okay, so let's start with the most basic idea of how long it takes for an ICBM, that is an intercontinental ballistic missile. And for listeners who don't know, in layman's terms, it's a giant rocket with a nuclear warhead in its nose cone. And it launches off a launch pad in an enemy nation coming to the United States. How long does it take? Well, the actual specifics of it from Russia, it would be 26 minutes and 40 seconds. From North Korea, it would be 33 minutes. Let's call it 30 minutes. You get the idea. And this is, of course, shocking because the average person has no idea that this is the time frame from launch to target. And when you think about that 30-minute target, now suddenly the idea that the United States has spent trillions of dollars having things like a SBIR satellite system in space to notify the national command authority within a second, because you only have 30 minutes to launch your own nuclear weapons. If you go back to the 50s, the big threat was that Russia would launch a preemptive attack on America and take out all our nuclear apparatus and thereby win the war, you know, in under 30 seconds. And so you kind of have to learn these seconds and minutes, and I try to help the reader learn them very quickly in the book. And then suddenly the dominoes begin to fall and you realize, my God, this is why it is all happening so fast. This is why the president has 6 minutes.
And one of the things in your books that will seem alarming to many people, and certainly was alarming to me, is that the chain of command doesn't seem to be as absolutely kind of perfect as one might hope. I mean, you describe how, you know, if the president is out of communication for whatever reason, I won't kind of spoil your book, the head of Stratcom has the power and quite soon the means to an authority to launch, even though he's not technically the acting president. And you get a kind of face-off between an acting president who maybe doesn't want to and is having these what if Russians love their children too feelings, and head of Stratcom, he says, my absolute duty is to follow the protocol and do this, and I have the launch code, so I'm gonna. Is it really that much of a toss-up in reality? Have you any reason to think that they've updated these protocols?
So I'll answer the back part of the question first, and then I'll fill it in. But I asked a couple of individuals who are not sources for me in the book, but who had just retired from nuclear command and control positions, to read the book in the last stages of before it went to print so that I could be very certain about some of my reporting. For example, exactly what you're talking about. And the one word answer that came back from one general who ran these scenarios for NORAD said, terrifying, period. Not, Annie, you have this wrong. Not, oh my God, that would never happen. Just terrifying. So what we're talking about here stems from another concept called sole authority, that the President of the United States asks permission of no one to launch nuclear weapons, comes as a surprise to almost anyone who isn't uniquely familiar with all this. You say, how could that be in a democracy? And again, because of the 30-minute window we're talking about. But the president doesn't ask the Secretary of Defense. He doesn't ask the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He doesn't ask them their permission. He doesn't even have to ask the Congress. He simply must make a decision. And so in reporting how that decision tree plays out, I learned that in a very specific situation, the president might be asked to provide STRATCOM, and that is U.S. Strategic Command, that is the organization that is in charge of the nukes, in Omaha, Nebraska. The STRATCOM commander might ask the president for something called a universal unlock code. And the way that that was explained, and I relay in the book, is if the initial launch that the president orders is 82 weapons, which has been demonstrated to be what is most likely the response to a single launch from North Korea at Washington, D.C., the response would likely be 82 weapons to take out North Korea's command and control. And the situation is, well, what happens if we can't reach the president after the launch is ordered and he's being moved to an underground bunker? We need what is called the universal unlock code so that we can launch more weapons in the event that we can't reach the president. And you say to yourself, well, how could that be possible? And then you learn, well, that actually is a very real thing. And the way it was said was, you know, imagine it this way. If the president orders the launch of 82 nuclear weapons, the technology is set up so that a missileer on the ground, for example, can't launch 83 weapons. It is precisely what the president orders. After that order comes through, new codes need to be generated. You can imagine the bureaucracy involved, going to the NSA, getting these new passcodes, handing them down through the chain of command, which gives this tiny little pathway to power for STRATCOM in the event they need it in the form of the universal unlock code. And if the president authorizes that, then STRATCOM and the STRATCOM commander specifically now has the authority to launch the rest of the nuclear triad.
And in your scenario, it comes to a very, very sticky end. Now, you've been talking about not being able to get the president on the phone. One of the reasons it comes to a sticky end in your description of it is that it's impossible to get the Russians on the phone. Now, I would have thought, and I think most listeners would think, there has got to be a reliable way of getting the Russians on the phone, because it's in everybody's interests. I mean, as you describe, in order to reach North Korea, you have to fly over Russian airspace, which is why they might mistake a launch for an attack on them. But is it really likely that the Russians aren't going to be, you know, picking up whatever secure channel red telephone line there is, even if relations between us are quite bad?
Yes, but let me drill down first on something that you said almost casually, which to this reporter's eye was the most shocking piece of information I learned in reporting the entire book. And that is that in the event that the United States were to launch ICBMs at North Korea, our ICBMs do not have enough range to fly in a straight line to North Korea. They have to fly over Russia. And this was confirmed to me by two sources, one of whom is Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta. And so this is an actual fact. And that is incredibly dangerous. Imagine even being able to get the president of Russia on the phone with heightened tensions, with nuclear bombs going off, and saying, oh, please trust us. These weapons are not coming for you. They're just going to fly over you and land on North Korea. That in and of itself requires a lot of good faith. But the second part of your question was, and I'm paraphrasing you, is, Annie, that sounds ridiculous. Of course we could get the Russian president on the red phone at a time like this. And I'm going to use a really frightening example. Shortly after the war in Ukraine began, there was an erroneously reported missile attack on Poland, a NATO country, right? A missile had allegedly landed in Poland. And as it turned out, this was misreported. But for a brief period of time, like a couple days, it was not known to be 100% in error. And only at a press conference some 36 hours after this initial alleged attack did General Milley, then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, give a press conference saying that he was unable to reach his Russian counterpart yet. Now that really frightened me, because that is absolutely real-time demonstration of how bad the communication systems are between America and Russia, let alone between America and North Korea.
Talking about Russia, because obviously the Russian response is part of how this unfolds, how much do we know of the Kremlin's capacity? You describe they're very proud. I don't know whether this is truthful or propaganda, of having this gigantic computer, which is, you know, three times as fast and a million more petaflops a second than anything the Pentagon has. But they also have an incredibly crap early warning system, which mistakes clouds for nuclear launches and so forth. Is that up-to-date information?
Again, that was another astonishing fact to learn, and again, confirmed with multiple sources, including Pavel Podvig, who works with the United Nations as the Russia expert on the Russian nuclear command and control systems. Russia's Tundra system is their equivalent of our SBIRS system, and almost everyone agrees that that system is terribly flawed. As you said, their satellites, they don't have what's called look-down capability. And so unlike SBIRS, which can look down and see that hot rocket exhaust and confirm that it's coming from the launch pad, the Tundra systems have to look down at an angle. And as it was presented to me by those who are very up to date on the technology behind all that, in layman's term, what that means, yes, the Tundra system, its sensors can mistake sunlight or clouds for a nuclear launch. And by the way, have in the past. And I write about one particularly harrowing situation in the book.
Why does it not have look-down capacity? I thought the deal with satellites was they were always looking down. Can it not overfly the things that it needs to overfly?
It doesn't have the same advanced technology that our system has. And so that also begs the question, how great is this computer system down in the basement bunker of, you know, Russia's version of the Pentagon bunker? Because we're just taking their word for it. There's no way to authenticate that information. We don't have a spy in the Kremlin's basement that I know of. But this begs the bigger question of, when nuclear-armed nations posture about their early warning technology systems being so fantastic, and then you learn of their fatal flaws or potentially fatal flaws, it opens up the whole door for a set of potential disasters, and that's what you see unfolding in nuclear war, a scenario because national security experts relayed to me that these are the fears with which many people in the national security apparatus here in America live with. They really, really worry about these kind of problems. Again, looping back to why I believe many of these people were willing to go on the record with me.
I guess, I mean, one of the things that you skirt around here and there in the book is the question of game theory and the geopolitics of this. And I guess the defenders of the status quo would say, look, we have all these mad sounding ideas like launch on warning and, you know, an absolute doctrine that you retaliate with 82 missiles to a single one and so on. But it's the extremity and the kind of madness of that that in a kind of game theoretical way produces the equilibrium. You know, if you're someone who's going to hesitate, if you're going to be someone who, as you say, absorbs an attack before fighting back, that makes it more likely that somebody might launch against you. Do you give that any credence?
You know, I touch upon policies as I set the stage for the scenario. And of course, many of these doctrines and documents are all noted in the back of the book for those who want to read further. But I think the summation that really hit home the hardest to me was the declassification of the 1983 nuclear war game called Proud Prophet. You know, hundreds of these scenarios are run by the Pentagon every year, and almost none of them are declassified. Proud Prophet's declassification raises questions about that very word because like 90% of it is blacked out. But it gives us just enough to see sort of time and place. And it also allowed one of the participants, a Yale professor named Paul Bracken, to speak about it without going to prison. And what Bracken said about the Proud Prophet nuclear war game, I think might answer your question best, which is that no matter how nuclear war begins, the Proud Prophet scenario, he explained, showed situations where NATO was involved, NATO wasn't involved. China got involved, China didn't get involved. You know, strategic weapons were used, tactical weapons were used. What Bracken tells us, the public, is that no matter how nuclear war begins, it ends only in one way, and that is in nuclear Armageddon.
And what does nuclear Armageddon look like in your scenario? What is there about it? I mean, I think we've probably all got all sorts of ideas we've got from fiction and elsewhere about how the world ends and nuclear winter and so forth. How would it, you know, what would you say that would, if you like, shake up our understanding of it?
Mm-hmm. There are two scholars who have reported about the nuclear mega fires that would happen around every nuclear bomb drop. And we're talking about 100 or 200 square miles of fire. Professor Lynn Eden at Stanford has written about it in my interview, and also Professor Emeritus at MIT, Ted Postal, who formerly worked in the Pentagon. Both of them have given the public incredible accounts of specific technical accounts of what nuclear firestorm would look like and would result in. And I source both of them in my descriptions of how those firestorms set off these hurricanes of fire that after the bomb stop burn and burn and burn. And then to really bring home for readers to think about what the world is like after nuclear Armageddon and why it is nuclear Armageddon involves nuclear winter theory. And for this, I interviewed Professor Brian Toon, who is one of the five original authors of the nuclear winter theory that published in the early 1980s. Carl Sagan was the most famous lead author on that. He was Toon's professor at the time.
I think, as you say, it was poo-pooed by the defense establishment at the time.
They called it Soviet propaganda, right? And interestingly, the nuclear winter scientists, humble as they are, even conceded back then that the analog systems that allowed for climate modeling, you know, these were like sort of in the early days of big computers, had limitations to what they were speculating. Professor Toon has stayed on this issue for all these decades, and he has continued to write papers. And the newest papers with the newest state-of-the-art climate modeling systems show us that nuclear winter is worse than was originally imagined. Toon shared with me images and graphs and took me through the reality that the mid-latitudes, areas like Iowa and Ukraine, the breadbaskets of the world, these places will be frozen over for years, 7, 10 years, Toon says, these models now show us. The planet will plunge to as many as 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Sorry, I don't have the Celsius. The sunlight will be blocked out by up to 70%. And so there will be a nuclear little ice age, is how it's called. And then you have to really ask yourself, as agriculture fails, as man returns to his hunter-gatherer state, we are left with this haunting idea, a quote from Nikita Khrushchev in the 1960s, who said, "After nuclear war, the survivors will envy the dead."
It is, as you say, it's an extraordinarily grim scenario. But I wonder if you can account for, I mean, because you write this very pacily, and I mean, as a compliment to you, that it's quite exciting and people respond to, you know, you've written for television, you know, Jack Ryan series and that sort of thing. You've got a handle on the way in which people find this thrilling. How would you respond to people who say this is kind of disaster porn, this isn't something to be exciting rather than to be scared of? Why do we have that reaction to this, mm-hmm. do you think?
Well, great question. I asked that exact question to my sources. Every single one of them, I said, could I be accused of fear-mongering? And every one of them said no. Panetta said to me, former Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, said to me, "This is good that you're doing this. The people need to know." And so if I learned from writing the Jack Ryan series for Amazon about pacing and timing and popularity and interest, I stand behind that. Because one of the things I have found in my experience as a reporter in this domain is that many people are incredibly quick to criticize. You know, there's, and often I find that a way of kind of trying to keep, shall we say, regular people, of which I consider myself one of them, out. Okay. So it's one of the whole ways in which I have built my reporting career has been going to the smartest people in the room when perhaps the middle echelon people have disparaged me because I once upon a time wasn't an expert. And I always go to the top advisors because it's like Einstein said, right? If you really know what you're talking about, you are able to explain it to a child. And that is what I'm after in my reporting. Not that we're all children, but that we are all consumed with our own individual busy lives and our families and things that we're doing. And who's going to really take the time to nerd out on the specifics of nuclear threats? And so I presented nuclear war a scenario for precisely the reason that you said, to try and grab an audience by the throat and say, this is something that we all must pay attention to. Because my final thought is this. When I was a high school student in 1983, there was a television show called The Day After here in the United States, and it imagined a nuclear war between Soviet Russia and the United States. It was horrifying. ABC didn't want to put it on the air. That's how horrifying it was. But guess what happened? President Ronald Reagan watched it, and he, as he wrote in his memoirs, became depressed. But a depressed president is very different than a depressed public. And what he did was call up Gorbachev, and they had a treaty, and they reduced nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons have gone down, thanks to that treaty, from their all-time high of 70,000 to the 12,500 we have now. So I'm all for making something readable to all people.
And are you hoping or thinking that what your book might achieve is is some sort of pressure on government or on, I mean, you say ordinary people need to know, but I suppose there's probably not all that much ordinary people can do about the US nuclear weapons program.
I asked that very question to one of my sources once, like, why isn't more done to reduce this madness? And that individual said to me, the US Congress only pays attention to what people are paying attention to.
Well, that's a fair reply. Annie Jacobson, thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.